Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, accessing DNA evidence edition. Thank you for tuning in. On October 13th, 2010, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Skinner v. Switzer. The question in this case is whether a convicted prisoner seeking access to biological evidence for DNA testing may assert that claim in a civil rights action under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, or whether such a claim may be asserted only in a petition for a writ of habeas corpus. To discuss the case, we have Evan A. Young, who is an attorney in Texas. Mr. Young is counsel of record on an amicus brief in support of the respondent. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Young.
My name is Evan Young. I'm an attorney in practice in Texas, and I'm going to take a few minutes to discuss Skinner v. Switzer. My intention is to describe the case as objectively as I can, but I need to disclose up front that I was counsel of record for an amicus brief in support of the respondent. This case asks what appears to be a simple question about federal jurisdiction. Here's how that question is framed. Hypothesize a convicted state court criminal defendant. Years later, he goes to federal court and seeks post-conviction access to evidence, in this case, DNA evidence. Should that suit be brought under Section 1983 of Title 42 of the U.S. Code, or must it proceed as an application for a writ of habeas corpus? That's pretty much it, a purely procedural question about which label goes on a suit like the one I just described, Section 1983 or habeas corpus. Why would such a seemingly simple question capture the attention of the Supreme Court? Indeed, capture the court's attention twice. As I'll describe in a moment, the court actually thought it would have been able to answer that question last year, but ended up leaving it open, hence this case. I'm going to start by explaining why the distinction between Section 1983 and habeas corpus matters and where it came from. I'll then turn to the facts of this case. And finally, I'll describe the parties' arguments, both in the written briefs and in open court on October 13th. So first, what's the big deal about the label? And why isn't it easy enough to tell which one should be associated with this particular suit? The parties here are fighting strenuously over the label because big consequences flow from which one the court decides to apply. Everybody in this case agrees about the starting point. But that starting point is a little arcane to those unfamiliar with this area of the law, so I'm going to describe it briefly. Section 1983, enacted as part of the Civil Rights Act of 1871, creates a cause of action for anyone whose federal rights were violated by someone else under the color of state law. That is, whenever a government actor takes some step pursuant to its authority that results in the deprivation of a federal right, anyone can sue under Section 1983. Suits against police officers alleging unconstitutional use of force, or against a school principal because of some alleged Establishment Clause violation, are among the many, many types of Section 1983 challenges that federal courts hear. Habeas corpus serves a similar but narrower purpose. With respect to state court convictions, federal courts sitting in habeas can scrutinize one thing: does this person's conviction or sentence or custody violate federal law? Someone convicted after a trial that patently violated federal constitutional rights, for instance, can win relief in federal court sitting in habeas. But there are many procedural obstacles to a habeas suit that do not appear in Section 1983. For instance, before going to federal court seeking habeas relief, a state prisoner has to exhaust all available state remedies. Congress has also established strict time limits for habeas petitions, and Congress has made it hard to file more than one of them. And Congress has refused to allow federal courts sitting in habeas to grant relief to a state prisoner unless the U.S. Supreme Court itself has clearly established the legal principles underlying the claim. For these reasons, Section 1983 would be much easier than habeas for many claims. That's why the petitioner in this case, Henry Skinner, wants the court to conclude that he properly labeled his suit as a claim under Section 1983. One final bit of background before turning to the facts of this case. If you've just listened to the description of the two forms of relief, you might reasonably ask why any habeas claim couldn't also be a Section 1983 claim. Section 1983 grants relief whenever a federal right is denied under color of state law in any context. That's what habeas does in the context of criminal convictions. It sounds like habeas is merely a subset of Section 1983. The Supreme Court has, in fact, recognized that textual overlap. But in a case called Prizer v. Rodriguez in 1973, the court concluded that Congress's more specific and narrower habeas statute must be the exclusive mechanism. There would not be much point to Congress's careful limitations on habeas corpus, which are designed to promote federalism and respect for state courts, if a prisoner could simply avoid them altogether by labeling a claim under Section 1983. The rule from Prizer, which everyone in the current case accepts, is that whenever a prisoner's claim, if proven, would disturb the fact or duration of the confinement, in other words, if it would show the prisoner to have been wrongly convicted or sentenced, then that claim must be brought in habeas. By contrast, if a claim simply relates to the conditions of confinement, like a claim that the prison facilities were inadequate, then it may proceed under Section 1983. So far, so good. In 1994, the court heard Heck v. Humphrey. The plaintiff there was a state court convict wanting to sue a police officer and state prosecutors for damages. His claim was that the investigation had violated his federal rights by, among other things, destroying evidence that would have proved him innocent. He did not seek to be released. Should he be able to sue under Section 1983? At first blush, the answer would seem to be yes. He was not challenging his own conviction or sentence. But the court said that whenever a suit, if proven, would necessarily imply the invalidity of the conviction or sentence, whether the prisoner formally asks for release or not, he could not use Section 1983. Heck v. Humphrey was a case in which habeas corpus was the exclusive remedial scheme. What followed then was a series of cases involving parole procedure, prison discipline, in which the court had to monitor this line. The most important recent case was Wilkinson v. Dotson, where the court held that Ohio's parole procedures were unconstitutional, or rather that the claimant could allege that and do so in Section 1983. The court held that because the challenge was merely to procedures rather than to the results of the prisoner's individual parole proceeding, Section 1983 was proper. So this at long last brings us to Skinner v. Switzer. The discussion that we've just been having is, frankly, a little dry. It's a question of federal jurisdiction and not one that gets many hearts racing. And that's the way it was argued at the court, too. The justices were interested in the technical details of how to draw the line between Section 1983 and habeas. They did not ask any questions about the facts of the case. But we need to review those facts briefly. Back on New Year's Eve in 1993, someone killed Twyla Busby and her two sons at her home in Pampa, Texas. Henry Skinner, with whom Twyla was then living, was convicted of the crime and sentenced to death. He vigorously asserts his innocence. Over the course of various appeals in federal and state courts, Skinner has not disputed that he was at the home when the murders were committed, and he has not disputed having the blood of the victims on him when he was found by police several hours later in an ex-girlfriend's trailer. But he says that he was not, and because of the extreme amounts of alcohol and codeine he had earlier taken, physically could not have been conscious at the time of the murders, much less able to commit them. As for the blood, he says, it got on him when he did awaken, discovered the crime, and examined the victims. Skinner believes that the real killer was Twyla Busby's now-dead uncle. The police obtained various physical evidence at the scene. Not all of it was tested for DNA. Skinner's attorney could have tested these various samples at the time of trial, but decided not to. He believed that they would make things worse for Skinner by showing his guilt more conclusively, whereas leaving them untested allowed him to make the argument that the state's investigation had been shoddy. Skinner later and unsuccessfully argued that his counsel had been ineffective because of this decision. Some of these untested samples are the basis for the current case, which Skinner filed as a Section 1983 action. Skinner believes that the testing might demonstrate that Twyla's uncle may have committed the crime, which in turn would exonerate Skinner. So the question is, what label do the justices stick on Skinner's suit? Section 1983 or habeas? It's a bit of an accident that this case will decide that question. Last year, the Supreme Court decided District Attorney's Office versus Osborne, a case from Alaska that presented the same issue. But the court didn't answer it in Osborne because it concluded that the substantive federal right alleged in that case did not exist either way. Rather, the court concluded that DNA access claims were best left to the states, and particularly the state legislatures. Thus, there was no reason to decide in Osborne whether a claim should be brought under Section 1983 or under habeas corpus. But Osborne left open a narrow opportunity for a future case to make a due process challenge to state law governing post-conviction DNA access. Skinner's case gives the court the chance to answer the question it left open in Osborne. Indeed, Skinner was within an hour of execution when the court decided to hear his case. Like most states, Texas has adopted a law for post-conviction access to DNA evidence. But, again like most states, it does not simply hand over evidence upon demand. To grossly simplify, it requires showing that the available evidence would likely have generated some sort of different outcome, such as a decision not to prosecute or a different verdict. The Texas courts concluded in Skinner's case that the evidence would not have been able to overcome all the evidence that actually was presented at trial that showed his guilt. Skinner, of course, vigorously contests this assertion, claiming that if the untested DNA evidence is what he hopes it will be, then it, combined with the weaknesses he will point to in the state's case against him, could in fact clear his name. Remember that based on Prizer versus Rodriguez and Heck versus Humphrey and Wilkinson versus Dotson, both sides agree that direct attacks on a sentence or on imprisonment must be brought in habeas. So the question is, now that you've heard what Skinner alleges, does his suit do such a thing? Does it undermine his conviction or sentence sufficiently to amount to a habeas claim? The lower federal courts in his case thought so. He filed a Section 1983 suit in federal court in Texas. But because the Fifth Circuit thinks that such an effort is aimed at one goal only, showing innocence, the trial court in the Fifth Circuit said that Skinner would have to proceed in habeas if he could. But other circuits say that this sort of claim is properly brought under Section 1983. Under their view, seeking access to evidence might be a first step towards obtaining release, but that ultimate goal is irrelevant so long as the particular claim of access to evidence is not something that in itself compels a speedier release. Even if a convict gets hold of evidence, and indeed even if it is exculpatory to some degree or other, that does not mean that he walks free. It is just the first step in another process, the outcome of which is uncertain. To resolve the dispute among the circuits, which it had intended originally to do in Osborne, the court granted certiorari in Skinner, and it heard oral arguments on October 13th. Because this case raises a purely procedural question, the facts really matter very little, and at argument, the justices showed no interest in them at all. Rather, what motivated the briefing and argument of the parties was a strenuous effort to show which side of the line this sort of claim belongs on, Section 1983 or habeas. Skinner argues that Wilkinson versus Dotson compels the result, that his own claim is properly brought under 1983. Getting the evidence, just like getting a court to impose constitutional parole procedures, does not have anything to say about his own actual release. It is just a step along the road. Adhering to this test, he argues, is a clear rule that is easily followed. If the relief a prisoner actually seeks would not necessarily demonstrate the invalidity of a conviction or a sentence, then it is not a habeas case. And the evidence he gets, in this case, might confirm his guilt. It might be inconclusive. It might be exculpatory, but not sufficiently so to be a slam dunk to prove his innocence. Switzer, the district attorney, argues that the test Skinner would apply is too simplistic. All it does, she claims, is reward artful pleading. Skinner has already argued that he was innocent, and already argued that the DNA evidence should have been tested by his attorney, and he lost. If the actual testing had been necessary, the federal courts which heard his habeas petition could have ordered that discovery, because discovery is available in habeas. What District Attorney Switzer claims that Skinner is doing is avoiding the line of demarcation between Section 1983 and habeas by just barely stopping short of affirmatively and expressly seeking relief that would officially undermine his sentence. But the only reason to want DNA evidence at all, of course, is to prove innocence. She argues that the court ought to treat steps along the way to habeas as simply part of habeas, and therefore foreclose Section 1983 to claims like Skinner's. True, the evidence might not prove his innocence. Indeed, she thinks it won't. But the test for deciding whether a claim is a Section 1983 one, or an application for habeas relief, should not be whether the claim has merit. It is what the claimant is ultimately trying and hoping to do. Switzer also argues that Skinner should not even be able to bring this case at all. He went to Texas state court to get access to DNA evidence under the Texas statute, and that motion was denied. Under the Rooker-Feldman doctrine, federal courts cannot hear a case that amounts to an appeal of a final state court judgment. Only the U.S. Supreme Court can do that, but Skinner did not seek certiorari there. I want to take just a moment to discuss something that seems odd about the arguments in this case that I've just described. In order to win, each party has to emphasize the potential strengths of the other side. It would ordinarily be odd for a death penalty case to be devoid of much discussion of the reasons that the criminal defendant was innocent or guilty, or why the trial was fair or unfair. But Skinner's counsel could not focus the case on Skinner's innocence. Obviously, Skinner wants to avoid execution or even be set free, and he wants DNA access to be able to prove that he's innocent. But because those sorts of things sound an awful lot like habeas, Skinner has repeatedly stated that the evidence he wants may not be of any use to him. Because he wants to file a suit under Section 1983, he has to de-emphasize, for the moment at least, the ultimate value of the evidence. The district attorney, on the other hand, has to emphasize the power of DNA. She, of course, does not agree that it will prove him innocent and thinks that whatever the untested evidence reveals will be insufficient to disturb the conviction. She's convinced he's guilty. But because she does not want to defend a Section 1983 suit, and more importantly, does not want to defend a Section 1983 suit every time any prisoner decides to file one, when she, the district attorney, thinks such suits ought to be habeas cases instead, the district attorney emphasizes the potential of the DNA evidence. She emphasizes the only reason that Skinner wants it, which is to try to get himself released. By focusing on the connection between the DNA evidence and the conviction, she wants to make this case sound like habeas corpus. The parties, in other words, are in some ways emphasizing their opponent's strengths. Skinner, the death row inmate, emphasizes, for the moment at least, that the DNA evidence might do nothing for him. Switzer, the district attorney, emphasizes that the DNA evidence is being sought as an effort to prove innocence. At the argument, most members of the court recognized how complicated this seemingly simple case really is. It was hard for them even to figure out exactly what Skinner was challenging. If he was actually challenging the state court's judgment, then he would appear to be blocked by the Rooker-Feldman doctrine, which stops a loser in state court suits from starting all over again in federal court, unless it is in habeas. But during argument, Skinner's counsel seemed to make clear that he was challenging not the state court's action, but the Texas statute itself as construed by the state court. Justice Breyer is a likely vote for Skinner. He wrote Wilkinson versus Dotson and appears to be very satisfied with the test it imposes, where unless success in a particular lawsuit would necessarily demonstrate the invalidity of the conviction or sentence, it could proceed under Section 1983. Justice Elena Kagan also seemed disposed to vote that way. Justice Sonia Sotomayor had hard questions for both sides. Justices Ginsburg and Scalia seemed intrigued by the possibility that the prior cases just did not have enough in them to govern the outcome of this case. "We've never had a case like this," Justice Scalia said. This is significant because he has been among the most forceful voices for limiting what sorts of claims could be classified as habeas. Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Kennedy, and Justice Alito seemed more likely to support the district attorney. In Osborne, Justice Alito wrote a concurring opinion which more or less said that although the court didn't resolve this question, he would have done so, and in a way contrary to Skinner. Justice Thomas, as is his custom, said nothing at oral argument, but he, like Justice Scalia, has traditionally been a very strong voice opposing expansion of habeas corpus, which, in principle, might make him support Skinner rather than the district attorney. At the end of the argument, it appeared that a number of justices were looking for some workable, consistent test that would add on to the necessarily implies or demonstrates invalidity test. What else could that be? Skinner, of course, says that the test is just fine as it is. Switzer seems to argue that when a case is brought as part of the core criminal proceeding, then, whether it carefully stops short of demanding release or not, that claim is one that can only be brought in habeas. We'll know in a few months' time what the justices think. And thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org. /multimedia.